Welcome to Poems for Company. I'm your host, Brian Dillon. Today's show is titled, A Redwood, an Ancient Orchard, a Sequoia. Do you have a favorite tree you pay special attention to when you take a routine walk? Is it older than you? Do you presume it will outlive you by multiple generations? There's a cedar of Lebanon in the backyard of a home in Astoria that I walk by at least 3 times a week. When a fierce ice storm struck the town a few years ago, I approached this location with dread. Fortunately, only one branch of the tree had fallen. I like to imagine it's stronger for having survived that storm. We project so many attributes onto trees, including longevity and strength. We develop emotional attachments to trees. Redwoods are the world's tallest trees. The painter Albert Bierstadt depicted California redwoods and included humans in his images, sometimes on horseback, to give us a sense of the redwoods' massive scale. They are known for the heights they reach, as well as their longevity. They may live for many centuries. Certainly, that puts our lifespans in perspective. In Richard Power's magnificent 2018 novel, The Overstory, one character reminds us, it's a world of trees where humans have just arrived. Yes, and let's stay tuned to what some poets have to say about that. Dana Joya's poem from 1991, Becoming a Redwood, invites us to think like a tree with various senses operating. This redwood scans its immediate landscape, comprehends its situation visually. But you might agree that for this one redwood, auditory awareness dominates. The tree remains on high alert to its surroundings. Without further introduction, this is Dana Joya's Becoming a Redwood. Stand in a field long enough and the sounds start up again. The crickets, the invisible toad who claims that change is possible, and all the other life too small to name. First one, then another, until innumerable they merge into the single voice of a summer hill. Yes, it's hard to stand still, hour after hour, fixed as a fence post, hearing the steers snort in the dark pasture, smelling the manure, and paralyzed by the mystery of how a stone can bear to be a stone, the pain the grass endures breaking through the earth's crust. Unimaginable the redwoods on the far hill, rooted for centuries, the living wood grown tall and thickened with 100,000 days of light. The old windmill creaks in perfect time to the wind shaking the miles of pasture grass, and the last farmhouse light goes off. Something moves nearby. Coyotes hunt these hills, and packs of feral dogs. But standing here at night accepts all that. You are your own pale shadow in the quarter moon, moving more slowly than the crippled stars, part of the moonlight as the moonlight falls, part of the grass that answers the wind, part of the midnight's watchfulness that knows there is no silence but when danger comes. That's Becoming a Redwood by Dana Joya, former poet laureate of California who should know a thing or two about redwoods. The redwood hears crickets, a toad, steers snorting, an old windmill creaking as it turns, as well as wind-shaking miles of pasture grass. It senses movement at ground level, coyotes, packs of feral dogs. It recognizes when the last farmhouse light goes off. But this is a loner tree. Many trees are social, clustered with other trees, often others of their same species. This one seems isolated. It's aware of redwoods on the far hill, rooted for centuries. Perhaps this particular redwood acknowledges its own relative youthfulness in contrast to the far-off cluster of redwoods that have thickened with 100,000 days of light. Not to get too carried away by numbers, I'll note that the redwood's approximation of its fellow redwood's lifespan calculates very roughly to well over 275 years. And so we think of the title, Becoming a Redwood. This one tree, we are to understand, knows it has many years to go to achieve adult redwood status based on the models it sees on the far hill. I sense Joya's tree would prefer to be part of a stand of redwoods, to be in a community of supportive elders. Dana Joya also projects onto this redwood a surprising degree of empathy for stones, for grass. Let's hear the poem again, Becoming a Redwood. Stand in a field long enough, and the sounds start up again. The crickets, the invisible toad who claims that change is possible, and all the other life too small to name. First one, then another, until innumerable they merge into the single voice of a summer hill. Yes, it's hard to stand still, hour after hour, fixed as a fence post, hearing the steers snort in the dark pasture, smelling the manure, and paralyzed by the mystery of how a stone can bear to be a stone, the pain the grass endures breaking through the earth's crust. Unimaginable the redwoods on the far hill, rooted for centuries, the living wood grown tall and thickened with 100,000 days of light. The old windmill creaks in perfect time to the wind shaking the miles of pasture grass, and the last farmhouse light goes off. Something moves nearby. Coyotes hunt these hills, and packs of feral dogs, but standing here at night accepts all that. You are your own pale shadow in the quarter moon, moving more slowly than the crippled stars, part of the moonlight as the moonlight falls, part of the grass that answers the wind, part of the midnight's watchfulness that knows there is no silence but when danger comes. The redwood is paralyzed by the mystery of how a stone can bear to be a stone. No growth for that stone, no view to take in, whether of farmhouse lights in the distance or groups of stones at higher elevations. In relative terms, this redwood senses it's at a distinct advantage over the stones, and even the grasses which must endure breaking through the earth's crust. No human interaction occurs in Joya's poem. No human enters the poem, not to circle the ground at the redwood's base or to touch it. Yes, this redwood is alert to a windmill and a nearby farmhouse, but humans remain at a far distance from this redwood. We'll return to the poet Dana Joya in a few minutes. Let's shift to the ancient world and the role of an orchard in defining a man's identity. In the final book of Homer's Odyssey, the hero, Odysseus, absent from his home island for 20 years, has returned home in disguise. He has slaughtered the lusty suitors who, like arrogant drunks, tried to court his wife Penelope. He has reunited with Penelope. Now, after his 20-year absence, he must reunite with his elderly father. So Odysseus leaves the town and ventures to his father's orchard, where his father, Laertes, lives in the company of his field hands. Laertes, a widower, is grieving over the absence of his son and his own decline in authority. Though Laertes is dressed like an impoverished field hand, Odysseus immediately recognizes him. But Laertes does not recognize his long-absent son. While standing under a tall pear tree, Odysseus sees his father for the first time in 20 years and immediately weeps. This is an edited passage from the final book of Homer's Odyssey. Alone, Odysseus walked the orchard rows and vines. On a well-banked plot, Odysseus found his father in solitude, spading the earth around a young fruit tree. He wore a tunic patched and soiled, and leggings, oxhide patches, bound below his knees against the brambles, gauntlets on his hands, and on his head a goatskin cowl of sorrow. This was the figure Prince Odysseus found, wasted by years, racked, bowed under grief. The son paused by a tall pear tree and wept, then inwardly debated. Should he run forward and kiss his father and pour out his tale of war, adventure, and return, or should he first interrogate him, test him? Better that way, he thought. First, draw him out with sharp words, trouble him. His mind made up, he walked ahead. Laertes went on digging, head down by the sapling, damping the spade in. At his elbow then, his son spoke out. Old man, the orchard keeper you work for is no townsman. A good eye for growing things he has. There's not a nursling fig tree, vine stock, olive tree, or pear tree, or garden bed uncared for on this farm. But I might add, don't take offense. Your own appearance could be tidier. Old age, yes, but why the squalor and rags to boot? That's from the final book of Homer's Odyssey. Odysseus praises the well-maintained orchard. He criticizes his father's shabby appearance. Typically distrustful when encountering people, Odysseus decides to test his father. He tells an elaborate false story about himself. As the next passage I will read reveals, he finally reveals himself. But Laertes demands proof. So Odysseus discusses the orchard in a way no one else could. A twinge prickling up through his nostrils warned Odysseus he could not watch this any longer. He leaped and threw his arms around his father, kissed him, and said, "Oh, father, I am he, 20 years gone, and here I've come again in my own land." Laertes turned and found his voice to murmur, "If you are Odysseus, my son, come back, give me some proof, a sign to make me sure." His son replied, "Let's say the trees you gave me on this reverted plot of orchard once. I was a small boy at your heels, wheedling amid the young trees while you named each one. You gave me 13 pear, 10 apple trees, and 40 fig trees. 50 rows of vines were promised too, each one to bear in turn. Bunches of every hue would hang their ripening, weighed down by the god of summer days." The old man's knees failed him. His heart grew faint, recalling all that Odysseus calmly told. He clutched his son. After Odysseus reveals himself, embraces and kisses his father, he warns Laertes, "Hold back your tears, no grieving." When Odysseus recalls following his father roughly 40 years earlier, in what was then a newly planted orchard, his father, breathless, swoons. So both the muscle-bound hero Odysseus and his father weep and swoon, perhaps tweaking our view of masculinity in this ancient Greek world. But I digress. My focus is trees. Odysseus's appearance did not prove his identity to his father. So Odysseus recalls he was just a young boy when his father gifted him the young trees in the orchard. His brief story of wheedling at his father's heels when his father named the trees proves his identity. Odysseus does not simply name the trees. He recalls his connection to his father some 40 or more years earlier. In that time, the orchard has thrived, and Laertes, presumably, has sought some emotional refuge from his personal losses by tending his orchard in his old age. I will reread the key passage. Odysseus leaped and threw his arms around his father, kissed him and said, "Oh, father, I am he, 20 years gone, and here I've come again to my own land. Hold back your tears, no grieving." Laertes turned and found his voice to murmur, "If you are Odysseus, my son, come back. Give me some proof, a sign to make me sure." His son replied, "Let's say the trees you gave me on this riveted plot of orchard once. I was a small boy at your heels, wheedling amid the young trees, while you named each one. You gave me 13 pear, 10 apple trees, and 40 fig trees. 50 rows of vines were promised too, each one to bear in turn. Bunches of every hue would hang there ripening, weighed down by the god of summer days." The old man's knees failed him. His heart grew faint, recalling all that Odysseus calmly told. He clutched his son. Again, that's from the final book of Homer's Odyssey. Wheedling is a curious term here, suggesting that the child Odysseus knew how to flatter his father when it was to the boy's benefit. He grows up to be the smooth-tongued adult Odysseus of the Iliad and the Odyssey. In the Odyssey, as we heard, an account of trees in the orchard links son to father in a profoundly emotional way. Odysseus's brief narrative about the origin of the orchard allows him to renew his bond with Laertes. I began with Dana Joya's Becoming a Redwood, and I'll end with his very different poem, Planting a Sequoia. This is a 5-stanza poem, each stanza consisting of 5 lines. The poem is in free verse, that is, no effort is made to achieve end rhymes. And the poem relies on uneven line length. That's an almost casual, conversational style. But let's not be deceived. Without straining for emotional sentimentality or dramatic overload, the poet profoundly details a most personal event. Without further commentary, let's hear Dana Joya's Planting a Sequoia. "All afternoon, my brothers and I have worked in the orchard, digging this hole, laying you into it, carefully packing the soil. Rain blackened the horizon, but cold winds kept it over the Pacific, and the sky above us stayed the dull gray of an old year coming to an end. In Sicily, a father plants a tree to celebrate his first son's birth, an olive or fig tree, a sign that the earth has one more life to bear. I would have done the same, proudly laying new stock into my father's orchard, a green sapling rising among the twisted apple boughs, a promise of new fruit in other autumns. today, we kneel in the cold, planting you, our native giant, defying the practical custom of our fathers, wrapping in your roots a lock of hair, a piece of an infant's birth cord, all that remains above earth of a firstborn son, a few stray atoms brought back to the elements. We will give you what we can, our labor and our soil, water drawn from the earth when the skies fail, nights scented with the ocean fog, days softened by the circuit of bees. We plant you in the corner of the grove, bathed in western light, a slender shoot against the sunset. And when our family is no more, all of his unborn brothers dead, every niece and nephew scattered, the house torn down, his mother's beauty ashes in the air, I want you to stand among strangers, all young and ephemeral to you, silently keeping the secret of your birth. I suppose that because the poem is so understated, I find it difficult to read aloud. It chokes me up. The speaker acknowledges his emotions, but tamps them down as well as he packs the fresh dirt around the newly planted sequoia. The speaker is inspired by an Italian tradition of a father planting an olive or fig tree to commemorate the birth of a first son. In the moving middle stanza, the speaker notes that he's altering this Italian tradition on his California property. He says he wraps in the roots of the sequoia a lock of hair, a piece of an infant's birth cord, all that remains above earth of a firstborn son. These remnants of the dead infant will be part of something larger in the natural world. It's an act of love carried out by the speaker, the grieving father, along with his brothers, a most personal memorial that won't be known by any marker. This poem appears in Dana Gioia's volume, 99 Poems, in a section titled Remembrance. That section includes this epigraph: To the memory of my first son, Michael Jasper Gioia, briefest of joys, our life together. This oldest son lived for just 4 months. The speaker addresses the sequoia in the final two lines. I want you to stand among strangers, all young and ephemeral to you, silently keeping the secret of your birth. He imagines a long life for the sequoia, exactly what his newborn could not achieve. Why would he want to keep silent the secret of his birth, whether that refers to the burial and planting activity, the birth of the grown tree, or the birth of his first son, who brought the briefest of joys? Let's hear the whole poem once more. All afternoon, my brothers and I have worked in the orchard, digging this hole, laying you into it, carefully packing the soil. Rain blackened the horizon, but cold winds kept it over the Pacific, and the sky above us stayed the dull gray of an old year coming to an end. In Sicily, a father plants a tree to celebrate his first son's birth, an olive or a fig tree, a sign that the earth has one more life to bear. I would have done the same, proudly laying new stock into my father's orchard, a green sapling rising among the twisted apple boughs, a promise of new fruit in other autumns. But today, we kneel in the cold planting you, our native giant, defying the practical custom of our fathers, wrapping in your roots a lock of hair, a piece of an infant's birth cord, all that remains above earth of a firstborn son, a few stray atoms brought back to the elements. We will give you what we can, our labor and our soil, water drawn from the earth when the skies fail, nights scented with the ocean fog, days softened by the circuit of bees. We plant you in the corner of the grove, bathed in western light, a slender shoot against the sunset. And when our family is no more, all of his unborn brothers dead, every niece and nephew scattered, the house torn down, his mother's beauty ashes in the air, I want you to stand among strangers, all young and ephemeral to you, silently keeping the secret of your birth. Planting the sequoia is an act of affirmation. Many decades in the future, it will become our native giant. In terms of wood mass, the volume of the tree, the sequoia is the largest of trees. If the climate is right, if wildfires don't harm it, it could live to be 2,000 to 3,000 years old. Dana Joya's autobiographical speaker looks well beyond his own lifetime, beyond the lifetime of his extended family members, to imagine the tree thriving for generations. In an interview conducted a number of years ago, Joya said, "The tree still exists. It's over 60 feet high now and perfectly proportioned. My father," the poet said, "tended to it till the day he died, and it reflects that care." That autobiographical claim serves as a kind of link with Odysseus and Laertes. I hope this episode allows us to reflect on who we are in our relation to trees. This and other episodes of Poems for Company can be found at KMUN.org. There, too, is a list of the poems read on air. Dana Joya's two poems from today's show are included in his volume, 99 Poems. You may also access this show through Spotify, Pandora, and other apps. Our theme music is Philip Ahlberg's Going to the Sun from his CD, Live from Montana, available at sweetgrassmusic.com. Thanks for listening to Poems for Company.